You're listening to the Body.com's coverage of the 49th Annual InterScience Conference on Antimicrobial Agents and Chemotherapy, also known as ICAC 2009. The conference took place in San Francisco, California, from September 12th to September 15th, 2009.
This is Bonnie Goldman, editorial director of TheBody.com. 1 million people are estimated to be living with HIV in the United States. However, approximately 200,000 have no idea they are infected. You see, the majority of Americans have never been tested for HIV. So if they are HIV positive, they are not only missing out on life-saving treatment, but they are unknowingly putting their partners at risk. To solve this problem, 3 years ago this month, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued revised HIV testing recommendations to increase HIV testing in healthcare settings. Part of the changes to the guidelines included removing the requirement to get written consent for HIV testing and also no longer requiring HIV prevention counseling. Although some HIV groups remain against the removal of these requirements, the vast majority of people in the HIV community have backed the new recommendations. The lead author for the CDC's revised HIV testing recommendations is Dr. Bernard Branson. He has been chief architect for the CDC's activities surrounding new technologies for HIV testing. Dr. Branson has been involved in HIV counseling and testing for more than 20 years. Back in 1983, he founded the HIV-AIDS organization HERO in Baltimore, Maryland, and he initiated both Maryland's program for anonymous HIV counseling and testing and the state AIDS hotline. I had the chance to sit down with Dr. Branson recently to get a sense of how the expansion of HIV testing is going in the United States and what are some of the new HIV testing technologies. Welcome, Dr. Branson. I have here your recommendations. That was published September 22nd, 2006.
Just about 3 years ago.
Yeah, 3 years ago. Where are we now?
I think that we are in several places. First of all, I think the recommendations have taken hold somewhat in certain environments, and part of that, in fact, is because there has been expanded funding for testing. One of the main concerns that people have raised about attempting to do this is who's going to pay for it. Willingness in many places to undertake screening has been a positive factor, but the idea that there is lack of reimbursement has been a problem. In June of this year, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services sent an advisory to all the state Medicaid directors indicating that, in fact, HIV screening is reimbursable. And just earlier this week, on the 9th of September, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services did an advisory about a national coverage determination for Medicare to pay for screening. Medicare can only pay for preventive services if they're specifically authorized under certain statutory requirements. They've just published their decision memo for 30-day comment indicating that they would have Medicare also pay for screening. So I think those are very positive steps in terms of practical things it takes to implement the recommendations.
This is for people who don't have private health insurance.
Right.
If somebody walks into an emergency room and doesn't have private insurance and just on Medicaid or Medicare, then they can't get their test covered.
Right. Medicaid is a state-by-state decision, and obviously the economic implosion has interfered with a lot of state budgets to be able to cover that. And so in terms of what their priorities are, they may or may not cover it, depending on the state. So far, California is the only state to enact legislation that requires all health insurers to pay for HIV screening. Similar legislation was introduced but hasn't been passed yet in Washington, D.C. and in Texas.
That's one of the major problems with, I guess, implementing
the
CDC testing. What are some of the other problems?
I think that the other problems are part provider-sided and part patient-sided. I think that at this conference, there was the poster showing that a lot of patients still seem to think that you need to be eligible for an HIV test, that you have to have some factor so that even though they're infected, they refuse or decline the test because they think that they're not at risk for HIV infection. I think that we've created a culture over the last 25 years that says you have to basically do something socially undesirable in order to get HIV infection. People don't really want to acknowledge that, or they don't perceive that they have any reason to have encountered HIV. Therefore, they still don't accept the test, even when it's more routine.
I saw that study. I thought it was interesting, and I thought perhaps it's also that people think they're at great risk, and they go in for
a cut or they need stitches or something, and somebody offers them the test that will change their life forever, and they're just not ready for that kind of information at that moment. So maybe they've been thinking about testing, but it's such a dramatic thing for most people still, I think, in the United States.
There is that which I think influences a proportion of people, but to be honest with you, I think that that is much more in the provider's mind than it is in patients' minds. If you look at, this was now 3 years ago, the Kaiser survey with respect to HIV testing, where two-thirds of people said they didn't think you needed to do anything special to consent for an HIV test. Providers, I think, and that's been one of the barriers to implementation, they still harbor this feeling that HIV is very different, very life-changing. Well, in especially emergency department situations, all right, a cut on your finger may not be life-changing, but certainly a car accident or a heart attack or finding out that you have cancer is when you went in because you had a cough and you didn't think it was going to be any big deal. I don't think it's that different than those other circumstances. Dr. Holson in the Queens, I think, has also one of the best responses with respect to this issue when he says, everybody basically who comes in with a laceration, we give them a tetanus shot. In the Queens, what do you think your chances are of getting tetanus compared to your chances of getting HIV? So that we do certain preventive things in those circumstances that people just accept as a matter of course. In those environments, perhaps finding out that you have HIV would be much more significant, or not finding out that you have HIV would be much more significant.
I guess what I was getting at is the drama associated with HIV, both in the minds of practitioners and the minds of patients. Meaning it's still considered outside of the world of HIV. If you go where people don't know very much about HIV, they still think it's a deadly disease that will kill you immediately.
That, I think, is the most important misimpression that we need to correct. People have now looked at life expectancy studies, and they have looked at the relative benefits of several different medical interventions that we do. And what you can accomplish with effective antiretroviral therapy is quite remarkable compared to even the comprehensive care after a myocardial infarction, after heart attack. The antiretroviral therapy has so much more significant per-person survival benefit, and so that is the message I think people need to understand, is that HIV is not like it used to be.
How do we do that? How do we make people understand that?
I think it's going to take a period of time. I think that it's going to take more general awareness of not only how effective treatment is, but how simplified it's become. For a period of time when people had to take multiple medications every 4 hours or every 6 hours and eat with some and not eat with others, it was complicated. Now, with the combination of medications, in many circumstances, you're talking about taking one pill a day that has long-term benefit from that, where in many cases now I think people are talking about starting treatment earlier. But other concept that is sort of gaining traction is what's called test and treat, where you basically would potentially start people on treatment as soon as you find out that they're infected in order to help reduce their chances of spreading it to other people. So we've got two things that are going on. One is a personal benefit to an individual from a longer life expectancy, and the second is a benefit to the people they care about by reducing the chances that they might pass the infection on.
Let's go to some of the new technologies that are going to be used or are being used now. A lot of people don't know maybe they can get orally tested for HIV.
Yeah. There has been an oral test to collect a specimen for conventional testing since the mid-1990s. And of the rapid HIV tests, there have now been six approved since 2002. The first of them to be approved, the Orquick test, can work either on a fingerstick blood specimen or it can work on an oral fluid specimen that you get just by swabbing the gums. It's a screening test. It still needs to be confirmed, but the oral fluid test has made it a lot easier for people to do testing in settings where it's either not feasible or it is impossible to collect blood specimens. And so that, I think, has made a large difference in the acceptability of testing.
And people can get results within 20 minutes.
Right. Most of the rapid tests give results in, well, the definition is in less than half an hour that you can get results. Some as a few as 10 minutes, some 20 minutes, but yeah, all of them are nearly immediate.
I heard that some of them have some issues with being reliable.
There are two sides to that, right? One is that the problem with a false positive test had been the major concern of everybody with HIV testing since 1989 when the recommendations first came out. So that originally rapid tests weren't available in the United States because you could not give a person a result unless it was doubly confirmed afterwards. We don't do that in any other circumstance. You get a pap smear And if it is positive, that's just a screening test. It may not show something. If you look at the same issues with false positives in mammograms, we're not afraid of getting them simply because it may not be correct. That's the nature of screening tests. You want them to pick up everybody who's infected, even though they might be wrong sometimes. We've applied a very different standard to HIV tests, saying they have to be perfect compared to other things. Given that, the other concern that had been raised with respect to the oral fluid test, there had been these episodes where there were little clusters, excess numbers of false positives. And the company making that test had reformulated it earlier this year, and though there haven't been any subsequent reports of the excess numbers of false positives. That's not to say they'll never occur, but it is really a very, very low proportion, much lower than with any other diagnostic test.
I heard that one of the issues was the expiration date of the test, that a lot of clinics never got around to using all of them. By the time they used it, it was expired.
Well, certainly if you use anything that's expired, yeah. It's not going to work as well as something right. That's in date. I mean, I wouldn't eat expired food either.
Right.
And so obviously the consequences are unpredictable in that circumstance.
Right. What are some of the new technologies?
One technology that has been employed in a number of places around the country is using a test for RNA. Most of the tests up until now have been tests for antibody, which looks for the body's reaction to the virus. And depending on the test that you use, it may take anywhere between 2 weeks and 6 weeks for a person to develop antibodies to the virus.
You mean after the exposure?
After a person's been exposed to HIV. The RNA tests, which test for the actual viral RNA itself, will detect infection starting at 10 days after a person has been exposed to HIV. So number one, nothing is perfect. There's no morning after test that you can take. But the RNA tests will pick up infection earlier than the antibody tests. And in some groups of people, in particular among men who have sex with men, because infection is spreading so quickly, it's important to pick up infection early. For example, when in CDC's National HIV Behavioral Surveillance, 92% of men who have sex with men say that they have been tested for HIV before, and 3/4 say they've been tested in the past year. Yet, when they tested people who were HIV infected, they tested people during the surveillance, half of the people who were infected didn't know it. So that despite testing and despite relatively recent testing, people end up being infected and not being aware of it. When they have done these tests for the RNA in people who come in for antibody testing, anywhere between 10 and 20% of the people who were infected with HIV weren't positive for antibodies yet. So that picking them up with these earlier tests, with the RNA tests, ended up not giving a person a false sense of reassurance that they were uninfected. The problem with the RNA tests is that they're expensive. And so what people have tended to do to make it less expensive is what's called pooling, so that you would combine anywhere between 10 and 100 specimens together in order to test them at one time to save money. Outside the U.S., there have been for several years available these tests that will look for both HIV antigen and HIV antibody at the same time. Several companies have now indicated their intention to introduce those in the United States, both conventional tests where you send it off to the laboratory, plus one that's a rapid test. It looks like they'll detect infection within 4 days of the time that the RNA test picks up infection, and that will very likely help to identify people earlier in the stage of infection and miss fewer people who have been infected but haven't yet developed antibodies. This issue is the window period. We've talked about the window period for a long time. Each test has a different length of the window period, and the idea is to make it as short as possible. As I mentioned, there's no way to close the window period. For about the first 10 days after exposure, there's no test that will determine that a person has been infected. But certainly shortening it as much as possible is important. On the other hand, for people who have been recently exposed to HIV, if they should have a test that's negative, it still is important that they get retested in between 2 and 4 weeks in order to make sure, if they've had a risky exposure, that they haven't acquired HIV.
When should these new tests be rolled out then?
Well, I think that really depends on the manufacturers. They have to do the clinical trials and take that information to the FDA. I would love to be able to look into a crystal ball and say what's going to happen for sure. I think we're optimistic that we'll see them during 2010, mm-hmm. but that really depends entirely on the nature of the manufacturers and when they complete their clinical trials and get FDA approval.
What ever happened with the home test? There was this idea that you could test yourself.
Well, there is a home collection system
right.
where you obtain a specimen, you send it off to a laboratory. The idea of doing home tests, I think, is still a consideration. I think that there had been several companies had approached the FDA about seeking an approval for the home test. And at the meeting of the FDA's Blood Products Advisory Committee, the committee was, I think, positive. They saw that there would be a potential role for that. However, what we need to do, of course, is make sure that people can do the tests at home, that they can do it right at home, and if they get an answer, they understand what the answer means at home. I think that's the phase that we're at right now, where the companies are conducting clinical trials to see to it that somebody can just read the directions and do the test and get the right answer.
Won't it be like a pregnancy test? Women across the country are taking these pregnancy tests, and they're reading it pretty right and figuring out what to do with the results.
The situation with the pregnancy test is, you sort of see this all the time in the movies, where a woman goes out and buys 6 pregnancy tests and keeps doing it until they feel comfortable about what the right answer is. The significance of an HIV test result, negative or positive, and the correct answer from an HIV test result is, I think, in a different dimension than a pregnancy test for what happens. That's what I think we're waiting for at the current time. When you look at some of the early data when pregnancy tests were first introduced, probably people got the right answer only about 60% of the time. Mm-hmm. Now that they're more common and people are more used to it and more acquainted with it, I think that it is a higher degree of accuracy. Still, the issue with respect to HIV, you know, pregnancy test in general is done on urine. It's pretty easy. With HIV, you have to obtain a specimen, either an oral fluid specimen or a blood specimen. Some of the mistakes are going to come in that part, as opposed to just reading the test, but making sure that you got enough of a specimen and a correct specimen in order to get the right answer.
In 2010, it looks like there's going to be a lot of really interesting things for people who are worried about whether they have HIV.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I think that we're going to see continuing developments and evolution. The CDC works with manufacturers in order to try to bring things to the market that are going to be beneficial for screening. In addition to the fourth-generation tests, the antigen-antibody combination tests, there are several other more sensitive tests that may be able to be done on oral fluid that might detect antibody when the levels are lower, so it'll detect infection sooner. I think the other very interesting development is people are starting to put combinations of things together. For example, you would test for hepatitis C and HIV together mm-hmm. at the same time with the same specimen, because people who are susceptible to one condition may be susceptible to several, and if you could test for all of them at the same time, I think it'd be a huge advantage.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the issues since the recommendations in 2006. Is there a state-by-state issue that each state has to start deciding about opt-in or opt-out? And
opt-in and opt-out, I think, is perhaps an unfortunate term that has been applied because it leads to a whole lot of misunderstanding. But what CDC's recommendation has been since 2003 is that testing for HIV ought to be pretty much the same as any other routine diagnostic or screening test that you would get. So that usually when you go to the doctor and he says, I think you need a blood count, I think you need a cholesterol test, I think you need whatever, you don't sign for each one of them separately or individually or make up your mind and say, yeah, this I want, no, this I don't want. That's uncommon. In many places, that was the case with HIV. At the time that CDC's recommendations came out in 2006, there were 20 states that explicitly required by law that you had to sign a separate consent form and receive pretest counseling. Right now, there are only 7 states that still have those recommendations, so that 13 states had changed the recommendations to be consistent with making it easier both for providers and for patients to get their test results. A big part of the reason for this is what we talked about earlier, that we don't want to communicate to people that you need a special eligibility to get HIV tested. In many circumstances, and certainly emergency rooms are a good example of that. People don't necessarily want to go into an intimate discussion of what their sexual or drug using behavior are, especially if you're just separated by a curtain from somebody in the next bed. While they might be willing to take an HIV test, they might not be willing to go through this discussion of risk factors and things that used to be the basis for HIV testing. The second thing, though, that has happened in a lot of the testing that's happened at emergency departments is that at least half of the people who test positive in those programs don't have one of these risk factors. They basically are just, I think the way it's termed is biologically unlucky. You need to basically have sex with an infected person one time, and that's enough to do the trick. You don't necessarily have to have some kind of pattern of risky behavior in order to acquire HIV. So many places have made it easier to get HIV tested. A number of emergency departments, especially in urban, usually inner city areas, have undertaken HIV testing. All of them are finding HIV infection in people who didn't know that they had it. I think that it has resulted in a significant change in what's happened. When we looked at the National Health Interview Survey as a nationally representative sample, and they ask people, and they have been since the 1980s, have you been tested for HIV ever? And if you've been tested, were you tested in the last 12 months? It looked like starting in about 2002 through 2006, the number of people who said they'd ever been tested flattened out. It wasn't increasing. Although 10% of people consistently said they were tested in the last 12 months, the total number of people who said they tested sort of hit a plateau at about 40%. One of the concerns is if the same number of people say they were tested in the last year, but the total number of people who say they've been tested hasn't gone up, it means we're probably testing the same people over and over again. In 2007, the National Health Interview Survey indicated that the number of people who'd ever been tested went up by about 1.5 million. Similarly, if you look at the number of new diagnoses of HIV that are reported to CDC, that had stabilized since 2002 in the range of about 38,000 new diagnoses. And in 2007, that also went up 15% by about 5,000 people to just over 42,000 diagnoses. It looks like more people are getting tested, and it looks like more people who have HIV are learning of their diagnosis. And so I think that we're beginning to see some evidence that this change in approach is having a positive effect.
But isn't the change so small? Even in today's study that we looked at, such a small number of people were tested compared to the number of people who came into the emergency room.
I think that perhaps the misunderstanding that happened when the new recommendations came out was that suddenly it was going to sweep the entire country and we were going to test everybody in 6 months or something like that. And no one ever anticipated that that would happen. This is something that necessarily is going to be incremental. When I look at the potential change, a 15% increase in diagnoses in the first year, I think that's a large change, not a small change. When you look at basically something that has been a single approach that everyone had adopted for 25 years, to get this much adoption in a short period of time is actually, I think, quite positive.
Finally, I wanted to talk about something that Dr. Anthony Urbina called institutional racism. And he found that in St. Vincent's Hospital, it was very, very hard to implement testing for new admissions. They did a very, very extensive project where it was made very, very easy. It was part of the form, et cetera. It was very easy, but the physicians at that hospital were very reluctant to test people. He said, look at the former governor of New York. His wife might have been at risk for HIV and not know it, using her as an example. But still, the physicians were very reluctant. The testing rate was, I don't know what percentage, but incredibly small.
I wouldn't use the term institutional racism, but I would use the term institutional inertia.
Uh-huh.
I think that there has been this concept about HIV in that it's limited to certain groups of people, that you need special qualifications to test for it, that providing somebody a positive HIV test result is really different than doing anything else in medicine. Unfortunately, I think we created that circumstance perhaps in the early days when we didn't really know what an HIV test meant, when people were losing their jobs or getting thrown out of school when they tested HIV positive, when people were suspect simply because they got an HIV test, whether or not they tested positive. And I think that it takes a while to change that. I'm familiar with what happened at St. Vincent's, but also there have been several analyses looking at the difference in attitudes between medical residents and physicians who've been in practice for a while. The physicians who are younger, who are just now in training, don't share a lot of those same feelings. I think it's going to take a while for this change to percolate through a lot of institutions, for people to realize that this is something that we need to approach just as a health problem. I also, though, want to be careful, because there's a maldistribution of HIV in the United States. Nearly 50% of the cases occur among African Americans, who are 12% of the population. When you look again at representative surveys, another thing the National Center for Health Statistics does is the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, which shows that, for example, among African American men in their 40s, 4.5% of them are infected with HIV. Nearly 3% of the women are infected with HIV. I think that's not a message that that community has and resonates in what their likely potential risk is. And when I did a talk about this in Miami, there was a female black preacher who got up in the audience. She said, "Look, if that's profiling, profile me. If that is the nature of the risk and I'm not aware of it, I want someone to basically be coming and saying that we need to be taking these kinds of steps." I think we have to focus also on the population segments in the U.S. where HIV is most common. And there continues to be a perspective, again, that you have to have certain risk characteristics. Another thing I think that is of great concern has to do with gay men. It's the one group in the country where data shows that the incidence, the rates of new infection, are going up. It's going down in injection drug users, it's going down in many of the other population segments, but among gay men, new cases of HIV are increasing. And I think that is something else we have to battle, is a complacency in that group, which is, after having taken major steps in the 1980s to bring down the rates of new infection, perhaps because people are less familiar with someone who's had HIV or AIDS, perhaps because people think, well, the treatment is going to take care of it, I don't have to worry so much. We're confronting a different epidemic in that particular population group that I think we have to address.
Are there any good ideas out there about how to address it?
From my perspective, one of the things that we have to communicate, perhaps, is that gay men need to get tested more often. Even though a lot of them have been tested, if you're having a lot of different sexual partners and the likelihood of encountering someone who's infected is high, you need to basically find out more frequently whether or not you become infected with HIV. There are a number of effective behavioral interventions that have been done, but I think we do have to raise awareness that we're basically headed backwards instead of forwards in terms of the efforts it takes to prevent the spread of HIV.
I guess this is related to MSM, because I heard that certain people are using PCR testing before they date in New York.
Well, you know, first of all, PCR testing is the same as the RNA testing I was talking about.
But it's expensive.
It's expensive.
Currently,
it takes
$200.
A little while to get the result back and stuff like that. If you did something in the meantime, you can't necessarily trust that result. And as I mentioned, if you had been exposed less than 10 days ago, the PCR test is going to be wrong if you have it. But the thing that I think you're talking about, whether it's PCR or other tests, is something called serosorting, which is to use your test result to make a decision about what kind of protection you're going to use, what kind of partner that you're going to encounter. And I think that's something that probably warrants a little more exploration. It's quite clear that people who know they are infected are much less likely to, about, the figures show they're about 68% less likely to have risky behavior with an uninfected partner. And I think that while I'm not recommending that people go out and have PCR tests before they go out on a Friday night, part of CDC's 2006 recommendation is that providers should encourage patients and prospective sex partners to get tested before they initiate a new sexual relationship. I don't think that's such a far-fetched idea.
Just one more general question about HIV testing. If you ask like a group of heterosexual women in New York if they've ever been tested for HIV, most of them have not been offered an HIV test by their gynecologist.
Right.
It's just completely not common practice in the general population, in private offices.
I want to say it hasn't been common practice. In late 2008, in fact, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists came out with new recommendations for all of their members with respect to offering HIV testing. All right, so 2008, that was less than a year ago that these recommendations came out. The American College of Physicians actually came out for other internists to do the same kind of thing. This is the way these recommendations percolate through. I agree that it has been uncommon, and I think that that's unfortunate. I think we're now starting to see that change because these professional organizations obviously have influence on their members, and when they strongly recommend that the members offer tests, I think we're going to see that happen much more frequently.
I'm from New York, and in New York State, we have mandatory testing of all newborns, which is basically backwards testing of the mother. I don't know what other states offer mandatory testing, but are we seeing different numbers and different populations testing positive?
There are several other states now that have adopted that. Illinois is one, mandatory testing of newborns. The rationale for that testing is that if a baby is born to a mother who's HIV infected and you start treatment on the baby, preferably within 12 hours, you can cut that baby's chance of getting infected down by about 50%. And so some people have implemented the mandatory testing. In New York, to be honest with you, the biggest influence that the mandatory testing requirement had was to increase the proportion of women who got tested before they delivered. In other words, when the doctors found out the baby was going to be tested one way or the other, and they were going to find out if they missed testing the woman, the percentage of women getting tested went from in the 80s to well over 95%. It had these unintended consequences. And so we are, in the New York testing, discovering many fewer unsuspected cases among the newborns simply because, as we wanted, their mothers got tested. It's more effective if you start treatment during pregnancy, right, when the mother knows what's going on. But those kinds of tests for newborns used to be a way that we took a barometer of what was happening with respect to infection. And what we have seen is such a dramatic decrease in the number of cases of HIV among babies that were acquired from having been born to an infected mother that now the differences are small and infinitesimal. The one thing that information from New York did show is that in places like New York, where incidence is still relatively high, some babies are being born to mothers who test negative early in pregnancy and get infected while they're pregnant. So that has led to the recommendation that in places with high incidence, that pregnant women get a second test in their third trimester in order to make sure that they didn't acquire infection since they had their last negative test.
Another comment on testing during pregnancy. When women are tested during pregnancy, there is no counseling. It's just a mandatory test. Even though, I don't know if it's recommended, but it's a
voluntary test.
They just say, well, it is voluntary, but they're pretty strenuous. They say, we have this test, sign this.
This is a tiny bit of a sore point with me.
Okay.
When physicians do things or you check off things on a lab slip, there's a thing called an obstetric panel. For prenatal testing, the obstetric panel right now includes a blood count, blood type, test for syphilis, test for hepatitis, and a rubella titer. Doesn't include an HIV test. We had sought to get HIV included in that panel because the rates of testing for things like hepatitis, rubella, and syphilis are well over 95%, and the rates of testing for HIV are only about 65%. The real difference, basically, is to make it more difficult than checking off one box. In other words, if you have to check off two, the proportion of women who gets tested goes down. First of all, testing isn't mandatory for anybody. They have the opportunity to turn it down. What you're suggesting is what we are recommending, which is opt-out testing. Women should know that they're getting tested, right, for HIV, but you don't make a big deal out of it.
Right.
In that circumstance, because when you ask women, they don't mind. They want to make sure that the baby's protected, even if you're looking for something that's pretty rare in that circumstance. But I think that is the direction we would like to see testing happen in other circumstances where people say, all right, this is what we're doing today. Unless somebody comes out and says, no, I don't want that, you go ahead and proceed with it. That's the kind of routine I think that we'd like to see. Because as you raise the issue, is it happens with HIV? Well, you know, it also happens for hepatitis, syphilis, and rubella, and nobody gives that a second thought, right?
We're 3 years into the recommendations. Is it normal that it takes this long? I mean, recommendations are just recommendations, so it takes long for the implementation generally?
CDC first issued recommendations for more routine screening in acute care hospital settings, inpatient and outpatients, in 1992. Those never got adopted. Basically, by 2006, when these came out, we consider the 1992 recommendations to be the most widely ignored recommendation CDC had ever issued. Uh-huh. Now, the issue in 92 was that effective therapy wasn't available at that time. It wasn't really until 96 that we had highly active antiretroviral therapy, protease inhibitors, that we made a difference in life expectancy. And in 92, there was less direct benefit for patients to adopt those recommendations. As I think I said earlier, I'm pleasantly surprised at how much support, how many places have begun to adopt these kinds of recommendations. I would have been surprised if it swept the country in a single year to have everybody just undertake this kind of screening. It's a complicated issue in some states, certainly New York is an example. There are still some legal barriers that providers perceive in that situation. There are the financial barriers with respect to paying for the testing and getting reimbursement, a lot of which are still being worked out in many areas. So this is, I think, the way many things get adopted. You know, if you look at mammography recommendations, colonoscopy recommendations, I don't think we see 100% compliance with any of those. I don't want to suggest that I'm disappointed or that I think it's been slow. I think that we've seen a lot of positive movement. People are paying a lot of attention at national meetings, whether the retrovirus conference or at this conference on infectious diseases, there are increasing number of people who are presenting what their experience has been and showing that it's paying off.
Your mention of colonoscopy reminded me of something. What we're missing, I think, in HIV is an example of somebody who was saved by HIV testing. I don't remember the name of the newscaster whose husband died of colon cancer. And so she went crazy as she had a picture of him and she talked about it and she said, I'm getting tested, and talked about the consequences. And we don't have anybody. We have Madge Johnson talking a little bit about it, but we don't have any other examples of people who say, I was saved and I'm taking one pill a day and I'm cool. It's only the drug companies who are finding people to talk about HIV, but it's not the government and it's not any private entity, really.
I'm not sure that I entirely agree with that. I mean, I think that we have a lot of other examples. If you start back with breast cancer, when Betty Ford was diagnosed with breast cancer, in the media, you couldn't say breast and you couldn't say cancer at that point in time. And suddenly that became okay. Colonoscopy, if you remember that Reagan's colonoscopy was on television at one point in time. You know, you sort of detoxify for things with people in that regard. A powerful spokesperson, and I'm sorry I don't remember her name, but she's the editor of PAS magazine.
Regan Hoffman.
Yeah, Regan Hoffman. And she talks about that, and she is a person who basically says, and there are many people like her, that says, I found out I'm on medication, my life is being extended. So I don't think that we lack examples for people. I think that perhaps we lack a highly visible political person, or we lack perhaps a television newscaster or anchor person's husband or wife that would do that, that would bring attention to it. And I think that was one of the powerful things that Magic Johnson did do as a celebrity, is bringing attention to the fact. And he recently spoke at a prevention conference in Atlanta, and one of the questions people said is, well, they think that you're different because you had a lot more money and you had access to special or unusual treatment, and encouraged him to say, I'm doing what anybody can do in terms of controlling their HIV infection. So yes, I think it would be helpful if we had some high visibility spokesperson point out how much difference this made. When the recommendations came out in 2006, it was very interesting. It was peppered with emails from people who say, oh, I'm so glad to see this happen because my daughter was going to the doctor for 2 years and nobody ever thought to do an HIV test. Or my son was having all these symptoms and all these health problems and it wasn't until they did an HIV test that they figured it out. Now they're on treatment and life is entirely different. Perhaps it would be helpful to have that kind of, you know, spokesperson. I think that the other thing that is likely to happen at some point in time is that a person who didn't get diagnosed is going to sue somebody for failing to diagnose them. And I think that's another thing that drives medical practice a lot in this country, litigation more than legislation or recommendations.
Or fear of litigation.
Right, right.
That is a good point. Because I think that's still an ongoing story. I've heard stories of elderly people having symptoms and going from hospital to doctor to figure out what's wrong with them.
Everybody has great stories about that. Celia Maxwell at Howard University, where they're doing screening in their institution, talks about an 84-year-old person whom they identified with HIV, and it turned out that he would go out every time his Social Security check in and find somebody to have sex with and ended up getting HIV infected. For older people, it's clear that they are less likely to discuss sexual activity with their providers. The provider is less likely to discuss it with them, and therefore the proportion of older people who are diagnosed very late in the course of the disease, developing AIDS within a year, is higher than it is for younger people. But still, for people under the age of 50, more than 36% of people who are reported with HIV each year as a new diagnosis have developed AIDS within a year. 45% of them develop AIDS within 3 years. Given that the time between infection and development of AIDS is 8 to 10 years, we're still finding most people way later than we should.
We really need to transform society to get people to get tested, to not be afraid of the stigma, and to understand that treatment is relatively simple now.
Yeah, I would sort of turn it in the direction, which is when people perceive the benefit that treatment is straightforward and effective and relatively simple, it will help for them to get into the same preventive mode that they are with other conditions where early detection makes a difference. And that's exactly the message that we need to get out.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebody.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
Thanks for listening to thebody.com's coverage of ICAC 2009. For more podcasts from this conference, as well as additional articles, interviews, and highlights, visit us online at thebody.com/ICAAC2009.